Howdy and welcome to River Talk, hosted by Priscilla Macy, Zach Collier, and me, Eric Weiseth. This week, our big topic is we have a guest. Peter Fox is here, and he's going to tell us just some crazy river stories from his past in the industry. But we always like to start with news of the week. So, Zach, Priscilla, anything you want to talk about?
So Zach will chime in here, but last week, a handful of us, or more than a handful of us, are working on getting the word out about Oregon Wildlands Act and urging members of Congress to keep it intact, including components of the bill that improve protections for the Wild and Scenic Rogue River and the surrounding wilderness area. So, American Whitewater and Outdoor Alliance put out an action alert that if you have already done like every action, it'll auto-populate your info and just send it to the appropriate members of Congress. If you haven't done it before, it's really easy to fill out and takes less than 5 minutes. So if you go to Outdoor Alliance's page on Facebook or on their website, you can find that every action form. Or if you know your members of Congress, feel free to call them. Because calls do actually make a big difference. Zach, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest, what's stopping the bill right now is Greg Walden, a Republican congressman he's my congressman from Eastern Oregon. And so if you're drinking buddies with Greg Walden, you can make a difference. You know, if you bowl with him or you can call him. I mean, if he changes his mind, this bill passes. So what we need now are like best friends of Greg Walden to change his mind. Of course, the actual alerts help, but if you have any way to call, Peter, you're here with us on the podcast. He's also your congressman. If you left a message at his office, that he is the big thing holding the whole thing back.
Got it.
Yeah. And just a little bit more on that for context. So Greg Walden introduced a bill to protect Crooked River Ranch against wildfire. And of course, wilderness areas in a way pose interesting management considerations for firefighting, since you're not allowed to use mechanized tools to fight fire in wilderness areas. So there's certainly some thought needing to be put into that problem as we experience more wildfires. And that's an extremely relevant thing to be thinking about for Southern Oregon. But in my opinion, and being someone that has lived in Southern Oregon for a long time, I don't think that protecting public lands and waterways has to be in conflict with protecting communities from fire. I think there's a lot of creative solutions that can be brought to the table in a bipartisan way, and it doesn't have to be a fight over fire versus public lands. And I think that our Congress just needs to be a little bit more creative in their thinking about it versus creating a battlefield over bills that are equally important.
Yeah. Cool. Well, hopefully that passes this week or doesn't pass. We'll know here pretty quick.
Yeah.
My only news this week is it's raining here in Oregon, and the boating's about to get really good. So it just seems like everybody went from being depressed about not paddling to everything is going off. So it's about to be a good week.
And people being depressed because they have to work.
Priscilla, do you have any big adventures planned based on this water?
Oh, I mean, I really wanted to go kayaking today. There's so Quartzville Creek is a really great run, and the water level today, a couple folks are planning to do upper through lower Quartzville, which is a world-class day. Well, I don't know world-class, but a prime-class day of boating in the Willamette Valley, going from, like, steep creek to big water style boating. So I really wanted to do that, but can't go away for a full day today. If water stays around, actually, no, this weekend we're going to be hanging out with family for the holidays, so no boating there. How about you?
I'm going to the Hood this afternoon. I think I'm just going to do the Hood a lot. It's going to be 8 feet, which is just big water fun.
Awesome.
It's a good opportunity to do some of those eccentric runs with this kind of water, but
yeah,
I'm staying close to home.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's I'm here because I like you guys so much and I enjoy doing this. It snowed 5 inches at my house this morning.
And, oh my gosh.
A bit more at the mountain. It's 15 minutes away. So hopefully I'm going to go skiing here soon. But yes, the precipitation, regardless of whether you're in Oregon or Idaho, seems to have arrived.
Yeah,
and it's time to go out and play in it for sure. So
yeah.
It's good signs. And the Hawaii snowpack is looking really good, which is exciting. Yeah. So last good. I looked, it was like 140% or something of normal.
That's a good sign.
Get those fingers crossed for the Oahe and maybe Charbridge Bruno and everything else down there this spring. So,
yeah.
Cool. Well, Zach, do you want to introduce our guest?
Yeah, Peter is, I'm going to call him a good friend. I hope he thinks the same. We've done some paddling together and spent some time together. And he guided for a company, Echo River Trips, that I worked for a long time as well. And that's how we met. And I think he started guiding, he's going to have to correct me here, in 1982. 1980. Yeah, I knew I'd mess that up. So, you know, almost 40 years of guiding experience and has done some of the most legendary trips in the world in rafts and is also a guru for whitewater rowing and is writing a book right now about whitewater rowing and the history of whitewater rowing. And so welcome, Peter. Well, thanks for being here with us.
Thanks, you guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
It's pouring here in Bend, Oregon.
Awesome. Awesome. I'm sure the boaters of Bend are pretty excited, too.
Yeah. Excited, and nobody's worried about fire today.
Yeah, those Crooked River grasslands are doing just fine today.
Yeah.
Well, Peter, do you want to give us a story of how you kind of started boating, why you got into it and where you started?
So I had no intention of becoming a river guide, and it kind of found me but I fell in love with it pretty fast when I did Echo's training in 1980. And the only reason I did it is because it was free and I was going to get to be on a river for 3 weekends. But I had no intention of being a river guide. But as soon as I got my hands on those 10-foot azures, it all changed. It was love at first sight. And I never looked back. I love to row. It's my favorite thing to do. It's my happy place.
What river did you start on?
Started training on the Stanislaus and then the South Fork of the American River. And at that time, Echo also ran the Tuolumne in California and the Merced. And so that was the basic package of rivers I started running.
And I'm a big fan of the Tuolumne. I know you spent a lot of time there. And I know you did a famous high water ascent. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because I know that springboarded you to a lot of other things, too.
Yeah, it was so in the beginning of my third year of guiding, was the year that would make it 1982, was the year that the Forest Service took away the 4,000 CFS cap for running the Tuolumne. Prior to 82, they didn't allow anybody to go on the water higher than 4 grand. But they realized that put them in the position of being liable if anything happened, so they decided to pass that on to the outfitters and leave it up to them to decide how high to run the river. And right on cue, the Tuolumne that year just came up and kept coming up and coming up. And commercial companies started to run it at 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000. And it was a very exciting year. And there was one more spike in the river. And all of the commercial trips canceled, and we had our truck all loaded. So we went down to the river, and we didn't even have any idea how high it was running because the gauge was underwater. But we, for some reason, had a good feeling about it and did a trip down the river. And the river ranger met us at the bridge at the end of the run, and he'd called up all the release stations and the dams upstream and told us we'd just run it at the highest the river had ever been run to that point at 13,500 CFS. And it was a super big jump for us as guides from the 8,000. The 8,000 on the Tuolumne is a handful, but jumping up another 5,500 was a significantly. I think the term world class probably applies to the Tuolumne at that level. It was pretty intense, and but we had a clean run and a just spectacular experience that followed by a tremendous piece of luck. The next day we were over on the Merced and just happened to run into John Yost and Richard Bangs, the two owners of Sobek Expeditions, who just happened to be needing new guides. And we brought in the slides from our Tuolumne descent and walked out of there with jobs at Sobek. My friend Dan Bolster and I, Danny, got a job on the Zambezi, and I got a job on the Biobio. So So that Tuolumne descent was a huge stepping stone for us.
And wasn't Dan's first – that was his first year at 82, right?
No, Danny started the same year I did in, okay. in 80. Yeah. And the and what really seemed to intrigue Zach last time we were, started talking about this was the fact that, that those days were the bucket boat days. Yeah. So we when I look at the history of whitewater rafting and my own experience, I feel that the boats we had at our disposal in the 1980s were really great boats. They were tough, maneuverable Avon professionals that you know went all over the world and did a lot of famous first ascents. They just did happen to be bucket boats, and people look back at bucket boats as if they're a dinosaur, which I guess they are, but they were really terrific handling boats with a small problem that is if they filled up with water, they lost their maneuverability, and there was a certain factor that, that wasn't isn't there with self-bailers. Now, you guys were interested in that. What would your questions be about the bucket boats?
Well, when you run a big river like that, like big volume, you know, chaos, do you have like people in the boat where their task is mostly just bailing? So it seems like you'd be constantly taking, you know, enough water over that that performance piece is just going to drop significantly, especially in anything that's not pool drop. It's constant going, that kind of thing.
Yes. Well, so the yes, you always have a bailer, and they tend to be working pretty steadily to keep the boat empty in a big water situation like that. But the most important thing is catching eddies, and if you know because if you don't catch eddies, things tend to spiral out of control. So you say on that particular run, we hit that big current. And we're just getting our feet under us, trying to figure out how to handle ourselves in that big current. And there's a key eddy we needed to catch above Sunderland's, which is the beginning of the steep section of rapids at the top of the Tuolumne Run. And when I tried to make that eddy, the first few strokes the boat didn't move at all. It was like it was glued to the current. That kind of thick, strong current really holds a boat. So we really had to sprint to get into that eddy, but what an eddy allows you to do, we had three bucket boats. You not only have the ability to regroup and talk and kind of get your bearings and all the things that happen is you can pause when you pause in an eddy, but it's important that you all bail. So you catch eddies, everybody bails, you get squared away, you go back out. So catching eddies becomes important for even more important than just in a self bailer. So, and you kind of have a rule if you're doing a big water descent like that in bucket boats, which is first boat catches the eddy, everybody catches the eddy behind them. If somebody doesn't make the eddy, say somebody filled up with water after the last rapid and they weren't able to pull over, everybody else pulls right out after them, chases them, so you don't let anybody go. So you have what can happen in bucket boats is somebody won't be able to make it eddy, the boats behind them keep following, those that are in the eddy pull out and follow, and it just becomes a situation where you're bailing as fast as you can trying to get back in control and get all of you in an eddy. So that's probably the biggest concern, although the other side of it is that those of us who are rowing bucket boats, we weren't all exactly excited about the advent of self-bailers, because self-bailers flip easier in certain hydraulics than bucket boats, because particularly Clavey Hole on the Tuolumne, which is a notorious boat flipper before the rapid was changed. I don't remember when the flood was that altered that rapid, but when we were running it back in the 80s, there was a hole that was a real boat flipper. And in a self-bailer, you would get through the falls, the first part of the rapid, and all the water would bail out of your boat, and then you'd be facing Clavey Hole with an empty boat that's a lot easier, stiffer than a bucket boat, and a lot easier, have a more tendency to flip in a certain kind, in that kind of a hydraulic than a boat that came through the falls, took a certain amount of water, and was able to go through the second hole with a ballast of a boat full of water. So sometimes that boat full of water really could help you with a bucket boat.
I think when we learned to run Clavey, we try to miss the hole. So I think back in the day, I'm guessing, Peter, you guys had water in the boat. You're like, let's just go for it. And I started with Baylor's. So yeah. It was like, hey, you're going to miss the hole. And if you go in the hole, you're probably going to flip. It's like two different ways to – you're more maneuverable with a self-bailer.
That's right.
But
yeah, that's true.
If you don't make the move, you're going to probably flip.
Yeah, I started on rowing gearboats that were self-bailers. Like that was the first, I don't know, 8 years of my guiding was primarily set in bucket boats. And and I really liked it. They're a lot lighter. They're nimble. You track better. It just – the key became not just getting through the rapid, but how could you pick a line where you missed the most waves?
Yeah.
So you didn't have to bail as much. But –
Yeah,
I always liked that. Now, that was always my thought, too, was the same thing with the ballast. It's one of the interesting things I find about Ayers boats where they have that, you know, chamber in the bottom and you end up with water in there. Sort of the same, you accomplish a little bit of the same feel.
Interesting. What boats were you rowing back then?
We had Rogue inflatables. I started off rowing, you know, 18-foot Rogue inflatables for years upon the salmon that were bucket boats.
Yeah. Yeah, I and never rode one of those. Those are classics. They're supposed to be great boats, really well made. Yeah.
Phenomenal boats. They just, the way they could track and the way they could hold weight and everything else, they were great. Loved
orange, them. Too.
Orange and black. Yeah,
yeah. Best so the, I think that's, you know, as I have been reading about and studying that period of rowing, that happened starting, say, in the late 1960s, and up until the 1985 when the first self-bailers came in, that kind of bucket boat era of boats that were no longer just surplus rafts but were actually whitewater specifically manufactured boats, the Green Rivers and the Yampas, the Havasus and the Rogue River boats, a few boats, and then eventually the Avons in the early 70s came along with boats that had greater capability than the Army surplus boats, the surplus boats from World War II and Korea that were, you know, got the industry started, but lacked in some maneuverability. But just what you were just talking about, the ability to track some of those bucket boats and was really a change in how in the technique in rowing and started to create a series of changes that built on each other that started to broaden the scope of the skill set and the technique that rowers were using. Up until then, it was pretty much point and pull away from danger rowing, a lot of rowing upstream, slowing down, and the idea to be able to start driving a boat forward and tracking it was a new thing in the 70s and 80s.
Hmm. So,
oh, go ahead, Priscilla.
I was going to say, speaking of raft performance, I don't know if you talked about this on the earlier episode, but so Pete was a part of the first inflatable descent of the Stikine, and it was done in an 18-foot Sotar, which I hear was one of the first built. And so I think that, I think that story is incredible. To my understanding, it is the first attempted descent of the Grand Canyon Stikine in an inflatable craft.
Yes.
Had helicopter support. I've seen the video. It's a few times. It not only was the one of the early attempts in kayak and in raft, it also included a crew of both women and men. And it was the first complete, the trip was also the first complete descent of the canyon by kayak, with, of course, the exception of Site Z. So I was wondering if you would want to talk about that trip a little bit, and that obviously is a landmark in boating history in a number of ways, but just some of your thoughts on the trip and how, as someone on that trip, how that changed kayaking and inflatable navigation of really difficult whitewater in a few ways.
Okay, I'm trying to think of a way to tell this is a good story and not get too wonky on you here. But
get wonky.
So
yeah,
wonk
away.
Yeah.
Wonk away. The wonk away, Renee. The what happened is Danny Bolster and myself, who at that point had already done the first descent, first raft trip down the Futaleufú Fu River in early 1985. We got phone calls in the summer that they're trying to put together a crew to come up and do the Grand Canyon of the Stikine, and we were invited to go. So the crew of guides that was put together turned out to be really an amazing group of whitewater people who, some of them went on to be on world champion teams, USA teams, both men's and women's teams. As that stuff kind of came on after my era of boating was over, Mark Cassina and Beth Rippins both paddled on national teams and were involved in a lot of amazing stuff. It was an incredibly athletic group of people, and when we went into it, we thought we were going to row. We had a trailer full of equipment. Included rowing frames and oars and paddles and these brand new Sotar 18-foot self bailers. The 85 was the first year of the self bailers. I remember because I did a photo shoot of three self bailers on the Tuolumne that spring that were for River Runner magazine. And so we had a brand new boat and we headed off just with no plan except here are these things, go figure out how you're going to run the Stikine. And we spent 3 weeks paddling and rowing rivers in British Columbia on our way north, training, getting used to each other, figuring things out. And we had a guy with us, Jim Cassidy, who was a whitewater voyages kind of guru. He wrote some books about the rivers of California and maybe the West. Really interesting guy, a great thinker of an innovator in whitewater in his era. And he had this crazy idea. Whitewater Voyages had just started running Burnt Ranch Gorge. And they were the first company to do that, and they were running it in paddle boats. And he had the idea that the future of pushing the limits in whitewater was going to be in paddle boats, not in oar boats. And so he was advocating this, and this is before anybody thought to have a stern frame and a bunch of paddlers in the front, which ultimately turned out to be the great innovation of rowing and paddling mixed together to make a very maneuverable craft with some of the best of both worlds. But anyway, we were just trying to figure this stuff out as we went along. We put an oar frame in the middle. We had paddlers front and back behind it. We were trying all kinds of different things. And ultimately, when we got on the Stikine, we made the decision to go as a straight paddle boat. And so we had three kayakers with us and this one paddle boat with incredible helicopter support because we're doing it for a television program. So this was really an interesting moment in rafting history because, you know, normally if you're going to do a big descent, you would think oar boat. Definitely you want the power of those oars to be able to maneuver your boat. But thanks to Jim, really, we ended up in a paddle boat, and it was with the athleticism of the particular crew. We were a very strong paddle crew, and we ended up running all the river down to Site Z, except for Site Z. It's a longer story than that, but it was it took us a while to figure out who was going to be in the boat, who was not going to be in the boat, who was going to guide the boat. It was a big process. But I think if you ever get a chance to see the video, the part that I'm most proud of is to see the paddle boat in action down in, I think it's called Garden of the Gods, a rocky technical part of the river, later on in the river, where Mark Cassina's guiding the boat. And Mark Cassina was really one of the great heroes of that trip because he became the guy who both had the sense of humor and the personality and the guiding ability to be the one in the back of the boat, and he did a fantastic job. But that series of us making a bunch of technical moves through these giant rocks down on the Stikine is probably what I love to watch in that video, and it started to show some of the future of where having paddlers involved in whitewater rafting was going to be the future of how it was going to get pushed forward. And finally, whoever figured it out to build a stern frame and put paddlers in the front, that's how they run Cherry Creek today. That's how they run the Futaleufu today. It's become probably the most effective rafting craft. And we maybe had a little bit of a part in that.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty exciting. I know this will probably be a more contentious, but I think interesting issue that we've talked about a few times, or not issue, just development in terms of whitewater craft. So,
yeah.
And I know that there's a long-running debate that I've been reading that Joe Jones contributed to in 2012 on Mountain Buzz for people that used to use that. No, that was like the original Facebook of talking about kayaking. But it's this debate between creature crafters and other crafts and them defending their first quote unquote descent of the Stikine as the first inflatable descent, and this argument over what counts as a first descent. Do you have to run everything? Which they, of course, didn't, because they can't fit through the last Tanzania slot.
Right, right.
So what are your thoughts on creature crafters and the Stikine?
We're going back here, huh?
This is a great question.
Let's pull Peter into this.
Joe Jones, when you say Joe Jones, so you mean Joe Willie Jones? Yeah.
Correct,
so Joe Willie was a champion canoe paddler and had been a wide receiver somewhere in the Southeast Conference as a football player. Amazing athlete, long arms, long reach. He was one of our bow paddlers on the Stikine, and he and another guy that we nicknamed Stevie Golden Gloves. Stevie and Joe Willie were in the bow. Stevie was an NC2A champion swimmer. They're incredible athletes, and that long reach in the bow was incredible for catching eddies and everything, as you can imagine. So, in terms of creature craft, I rode a creature craft on the Futaleufu last year, 2 years ago, with pins and clips on it, incidentally. My first impression was it about killed me to row it in the wind down to the first rapid. So that.
Oh, I bet.
I've seen a video of that creature craft descent with Mark Kramer rowing one of those boats. And I know Mark Kramer because I've read his book and talked to him, and I'm in the middle of an ongoing conversation with him. Mark is one of the premier cataract boaters in the world. I don't know who is anymore, but there was a time when Mark was he eventually did the Triple Crown in a cataract, two of the legs of it solo, and he's an amazing guy, incredible preparation and commitment. He's done over 100 top to bottom North Fork of the Payette runs, so he's an amazing guy, and he was one of the guys who was involved in that trip down the Stikine and creature craft. I think it was the first one, and it was because he did the first two legs of the Triple Crown by himself, and he actually went to the Stikine and had his boat all rigged, put in, and was like, well, you know, I feel 90% of the way there, but I don't quite feel it. So he slept on it, and then got up the next morning. He still didn't feel great about it, and then so he packed his boat up and drove all the way back to Idaho and left the Stikine on the table for another year because just wasn't feeling it. Which to me, that's one of those kind of decisions that I think are the most important things for any river runner to learn, is to know when not to go.
Yeah,
and he was following his intuition, but he came back again a couple years later, trained up. You know, was all ready, went down the Stikine by himself in a cataract with incredible safety precautions. He studied the river extensively. He talked to everybody who'd run it. His preparation was amazing. He had sat phones. All the search and rescue people knew he was going. He had communication. He did an amazing preparation job. But he got down there and flipped in a pretty early rapid, and his boat was surfed into an eddy. And this is an amazing story. It's in his book. But he was hanging on to his raft, hugging his raft upside down, and it went around the eddy 23 times.
Oh my gosh!
Before he figured out a way that he could get out and rescue himself. And he was, so he would go down the eddy line, come up, back up the eddy, hold on to the thing. And right as he hit the eddy line at the top, the tubes would submerge. So it would go underwater every time. So, can imagine yourself going around, he's looking, studying the cliff, trying to see if there's a way he can get up. How can he get out of this eddy? What's he going to do? And unbelievably dire circumstance. Finally, he stays keeps his head above water, and that last little bit where he where he's had to hold his breath because he's going underwater again, he spots a little teeny ledge. The next time around, he's ready with his bow line. It doesn't work. He holds on. The next time around, he just makes this leap, gets one toe hold, gets his foot up there, somehow gets his raft, gets mechanical advantage, hauls it up the cliff out of the eddy, gets his bag, drops his bag in the water, rescues his bag, gets in his, pitches his tent, gets in his sleeping bag, and then the next morning, he uses mechanical advantage, pulls that thing out, gets down and crosses the river, the first landing zone he had figured out, and calls in a helicopter. So he gave it a hell of a shot in just a straight cataract, and his preparation, that's the kind of river it is. He was about as close as anybody might be and still rescue himself. And so he came back in the creature craft. So I think prior to the creature craft, the cutting edge of whitewater rafting was being done in cataracts. And by Mark Kramer and David Nissen and a few other people that I probably should know, but I don't know everybody. back to the creature craft. Creature craft is, I took it straight down the bridge to bridge section of the Futaleufu. Just ran wherever I wanted to. I didn't have to miss anything, and it was a lot of fun. It was weird because you can't see. In terms of just straight river running, I mean, it was fun, it just made it easy. But I don't quite know how to quantify, what's better or what's not. But when you look at Joe Willie Jones defending, our trip down there, we poured sight Zed. We had help from a helicopter. We didn't run the whole river. And as far as the creature craft getting down to the Tanzia slot, is that what?
I don't know if I'm saying it right.
Yeah, I think you said it right and I didn't, but it's basically the river's over. It's just calm water. It's just a narrow little slot. So getting through there, I don't think qualifies as not finishing the river. We did not complete a first complete descent. And the kayakers were with Lars Holbeck, Rob Lesser
McDougal,
yeah, those guys completed the first self-supported kayak descent, which means they didn't run every rapid, but they were good enough rock climbers that they portaged everything legitimately without any assistance from the helicopter or anything. So they ran, there's a lot of rivers that people consider first descents when they do portages, so I don't know if I answered your question at all.
Yeah, no, I think that did address some of the things that I was pondering about. I think in this discussion I'm referencing on Mountain Buzz is there's this ongoing argument of what counts as a first descent versus a first full descent. And I think for most people in the community that have been a part of any early descent or first descent of a creek without with limited information would agree that you don't have to run everything to consider it a first descent, but it lays down the framework for future groups to do full descents. Anyone that's been in a new place, especially back before, YouTube and GoPro footage and satellite imagery that's of high quality, you're going into this place with such limited information. Like, that in itself is an impressive feat. And I think it's hard for people who have boated in more recent time and don't understand what is involved in planning and executing a trip like that. It's hard for them to say, like, well, it wasn't a first descent unless you ran everything. It's like, well, there's a lot of other components to exploring and doing something that hasn't been done before. And just because you didn't run the hardest of the rapids doesn't mean it doesn't count.
Well, I'm blissfully ignorant of those debates, but I would say that there is another aspect, another way of looking at it that I would contend is the most important way. A first descent is not like a merit badge that you put on your on your thing, and it's that's the whole idea is the experience and what it means to you and the the adventure and the challenge of scouting and reading a brand new river that's never been run. And I would say, going back to talk about Mark Kramer, who walked away from the Stikine the same year he'd run the first two legs of the Triple Crown, he walked away from it. I would say that that is a fabulous decision by a river runner, and that that's something that he should be as proud of as a river runner as anything. And you know, the idea of coming to a river and looking inside yourself and saying, "Hey, how do I feel? Do I think I've got this? Am I is this good to go?" And the personal challenge and looking inside yourself that's involved in whether you want to call it a first descent or complete descent or not. I think that all of that doesn't really matter. It just matters for you as a river runner and your experience and your honesty, being integrity with the river.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it.
Peter, I love talking about the Stikine, but we have limited time, and I really want to hear more. I want to talk about the Fudalafu, because that was a cool story too. And I think it starts with, if I remember right, you being on the BOBO.
Right. So I got a job with Sobeck and went down in 1983, three high water BOBO trips with them. Danny Bolster went to the Zambezi, met Steve Curry. Steve Curry hired Danny to come back over to the BOBO, so he was also on the BOBO that year. The next year I came down and worked for Steve, and so both Danny and I were working for Steve Curry on the BOBO. And the BOBO was under a death sentence. Everybody knew it was going to be dammed in the 90s. Everything was in place. The river's going to be lost. So Steve Curry, Dan Bolster, and Jack Curry, who was down there in 83, were in a Puerto Montt hotel room going through a stack of topographic maps trying to find the next great rafting river in Chile. And the one that they identified was the river that has now become the Fudalafu. Then it was just a blue line on a map, on a topo map. And so after working in 84 for Steve, January in 84 for Steve on the Fudalafu, on the BOBO, Danny and I and a couple of friends traveled south for 3 days on buses and trains and ferries and vans and got to the town of Fudalafu and tried to look around and see the river, which was kind of hard. Our Spanish wasn't very good, and the deep and the canyons are kind of inaccessible. So we went back to Puerto Montt, reached Steve in the States, rented a plane and flew over it, photographed it, looked, wow, this looks like an amazing river from the air where you can't see how powerful it is. And so we came back in 1985 after the BOBO season with a full-on, expedition style, trip, just like you'd run the Middle Fork of the Salmon or the Grand Canyon. We had all of our food and our camping gear and everything loaded in the boats and started at the top and went down the Fudalafu. And we went through the first canyon that they now call the Infierno Canyon. And we had spent about, I don't know how many hours, bushwhacking up in the forest to see the whole length of that canyon before there was any trail. It was, it looked pretty good. Again, from up high, it looked pretty good. Yeah, that's a nice rapid, but there's a line there. Let's run it. We ran that canyon, which at that water level that we saw was kind of one rapid. We got to the bottom, and we were just shocked because Steve Curry, who was an outfitter on the Selway for back to the early 70s and saw huge high water trips on the Selway and on the Middle Fork of the Salmon in his career, and whose dad was a Grand Canyon outfitter and saw huge water back in the day in the Grand Canyon. None of us had ever experienced a river that had quite the punch that the Fudalafu had. It wasn't that big. It wasn't as big as the Grand Canyon, but it just had a punch. And so at that point we knew we were really in for more than we had expected to be. And nowadays when people run the Fudalafu, they run pieces of the river from camps. Nobody loads up with a bunch of gear and runs it from the top. It's just not done. And the water levels are very sensitive. There's certain parts of the river they'll run at certain water levels and certain parts they won't. So they have it kind of dialed in now. But then we were on the river at pretty high water and just went from the top. And with nothing. You know, we didn't really know how far we were from town. There was no civilization around at that time, except a few ranches you could kind of catch a glimpse of on a river left. So we just were on our own. And it was a, you know, one of those trips of a lifetime, because as I referenced earlier, we felt we were able to do it. We were in the right boats. We were in huge 22-foot self-bailing Moravias, giant rafts that could run big water. And we solved the problems as they came up. And ultimately, one of our boats got caught in a hole in the rapid that's called Terminator now. And it's such a big hole that the 22-foot raft stayed in the hole for a half an hour. And 32-inch stayed in for a half an hour. And there's a video of this that you could probably find on YouTube if you look for it. There's a video of this. The guy rowing it there was just a little freak pulse of the current that pushed him over into that right-hand channel at that beginning of the rapid. And once you have those boats going, there's no way to really turn them in a rapid. And he was thrown clear, had a world-class swim, and was picked up by our kayakers at the bottom. And fortunately, was wearing a dry suit and a good life jacket, and he survived it. But the boat stayed in for half an hour, and as we waded down below, the first thing that floated down the river was pieces of 3/4-inch plywood ripped up like cardboard. So it was an incredibly powerful hydraulic. And at that point, we were late for getting our passengers to what was supposed to be our rendezvous. They had flights out, and we just decided that we recovered the boat later, but we lost some gear. We decided to abort the trip right there. And so talking about complete or incomplete first ascents, you know, that was an incomplete first ascent. There were 7 more miles of the Futaleufu Fu that we never ran. But as far as we were concerned, we were just proud of ourselves and had felt like we had the most amazing experience. And it didn't really matter to us, you know, what you wanted to call it. For us, it was an incredibly special experience.
Yeah, the 7 miles below were easier than everything you did.
And you guys, yeah, we did the hard part. Yeah, we did the hard part. We didn't know.
Yeah.
and now the BOBO Expeditions camp down there is probably, you know, a few hundred meters away from where we took out. So when I went back there in 2014 with my family, I realized I was right at the spot where we'd finished our trip, which is pretty neat.
Wow.
The farmer who loaned us his pig barn that night in 1985, we spent our last night in what we called the Curry Hotel, which was this farmer's pig barn. He's still the neighbor of the BOBO camp down there, and he's about my age, somewhere in his 60s, and he was born in the house in the shack behind his current house. And has lived there his entire life. So the last, you know, since whatever, he's been there. And his son, who was a little boy hanging around while we were doing our takeout, he now drives the bus for BOBO Expeditions. So the valley hasn't changed that much, and it's a special place.
Do you want to tell us about who named the Rapid Terminator? Was the Rapid named Terminator after your trip?
Well, Steve Curry went back in 1991 with Eric Hertz, who would found Earth River Expeditions, and they did a full raft trip down the river, and finished those final miles and so forth. And as far as I know, they might have had a hand in naming some of those rapids, but I think the guy who probably deserves a lot of credit for really opening up the Futaleufu in its popularity was Chris Spelius. Chris Spelius was down in Chile in 1985, and we had done another river with him prior to going to the Futaleufu, and he had to take a Payson and Aurelia Kennedy, the owners of the Nantahala Outdoor Center. He had to take them back to their flight in Santiago, so he didn't come down to the Futaleufu with us. But he came back in 85, paddled the river. He was a kayaker, and he started bringing groups of kayakers down there right away in the 80s. And he was probably the guy who started to spread the reputation of the Futaleufu. And so it could have been Spelius who named the rapids. I don't really know. I didn't go back for 30 years, and Danny Bolster's never been back, and Steve Curry's expedition has never ran the river. So we really, we never really kept up with how all that happened. So, but I assume that Terminator is in some way referencing the fact that that's where our trip terminated. We call that rapid TKO, for technical knockout. Anyway, so.
But and after that first boat flipped, you guys didn't run the rapid. He ran. That was Brad Lord, right? He ran.
It is Brad, yeah. So we from the flyover, we knew that there were big long rapids downstream that we kept trying to get close to, and the the whole thing was a saga. We weren't making very many miles. It was pouring rain. We had a group of passengers. We had to cook and take care of the passengers, just because it was a commercial trip. It was a commercial first ascent.
That's crazy.
There was a little push pull going on between the passengers and the guides, because we got to get closer to those rapids. We want to be able to scout them from camp. It's killing us. It's taking us 4 hours or whatever to get through the rapid they call Zeta. It took us 24 hours. We had to camp above the rapid. It took us that long to solve that how to run that rapid. So everything was taking us a long time, and we got to Terminator. It had been 3 really long days, bad weather, super tense situations. We hadn't slept particularly well in the rain, and we got to Terminator and spent 4 hours scouting. It was easier to scout back then because there had been a fire in the canyon, and the riverbank was more accessible on river, right, than it is now. But we scouted the whole, most of the thing, 2/3 of the way down, and then we ran into that giant hole that completely, took our breath away, and we had to rethink the whole thing. So long, intense scouting mission. The passengers had walked around it, and we took off the 4 boats. We got back up to the beach where the boats were tied up, and had one of those meetings, those huddles where you look each other in the eye and say, okay, so are we going to do this? If you got a good feeling, is everybody okay about doing this? And everybody was ready. And we rode off the beach after all that scouting across from the eddy, and the first 2 boats, me and Danny Bolster, we rode up under this boil of the water coming back up from the rapid up around the corner that we hadn't really taken into account, because we scouted everything below. We didn't look across the darn river. So Danny and I went up in this boil, like a big Grand Canyon boil, and we're fighting to keep our boat straight and get off of it and get onto the line. And Brad hesitated just a little bit as he was crossing the river. He was right on the edge of that boil, and it pulsed, and it kind of washed him over towards the right. So he ended up entering the rapid first on the right side of this key wave train, where each wave was surfing him farther right. And when we got off the boil, which was right behind him, we were on the left side of that wave train. So we were all the boats were going up and down on these 6-foot waves in this wave train, and we'd come to the top and we'd see Brad, and he'd surf a little farther to the right, and we'd surf a little farther to the left. Then we came up again and we'd see him disappearing in the distance, and we went to the left of a little rocky section in the middle of the river and lost sight of him. But the rest of us ran down the left side, which was doable, and all of us made it down there and got to the bottom of the rapid. But by the time we got to the big waves at the bottom, Brad had already swum through them, and his boat was already stuck in the hole. So we all ran the rapid, and Brad just was unfortunate to have done everything right and had a good feeling, everything he could ask for, and just that little hesitation because of the other boats slowing up and a little pulse, and then a 22-foot raft loaded up with plywood floors, boxes, and everything. Once you get it pointed downstream, there's no way to change and get across a 6-foot wave train to the other side of the river. So when we got to the bottom, Brad had already been rescued.
Oh, so you all basically launched together.
We launched together.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
We all launched together, and three of us made it through the rapid, and the one boat got stuck. And when it finally came loose, we rowed out and got our hands on it, but it was had too much momentum. We couldn't pull it in, so
yeah.
We had to chase it anyway. So, yeah, no, I don't know if you've seen Terminator, right?
Yeah, Zach? It's big.
It's big and long, and it's a pretty impressive hill. Pretty impressive hill. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. I haven't run it. I've looked at it, been like, no, I'm good. Like it's a big long rapid. Watch kayakers gut it down the middle, and it takes a lot of nerve to do that.
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah.
Peter, I want to ask you about. Sorry to move on. We just have I could ask talk about this forever about your project now. Like I know you're writing a book about whitewater rowing and how that's going and what you're doing.
Well, thanks for asking about that. I'm writing a book about basically I would describe it as how we learned to row, how as an industry and individuals and as a sport, rowing developed from its earliest recreational attempts to get down rivers, probably dated around the turn of the 20th century to where it is now. And it's talking about techniques and boats and how it just progressed. And there's just incredible stories along the way of, some of the people I've already mentioned that, make it a really fun project to think about and try to capture.
And I know that you have a million stories from the book. Do you want to just pick one interesting person? You keep telling me these cool stories. Just one quick story or even long story about some interesting person you've interviewed.
Oh, boy. Just the first thing that pops into my mind is not somebody I interviewed, somebody who was long gone before I was even born, a guy named Buzz Holmstrom, who he somehow got the idea that he wanted to be a river runner, and there was a geographic expedition that was going down the Grand Canyon in, I'm trying to think of the dates. I can't think of the dates right offhand, 20s or 30s, in the wooden boat era. And he had zero experience, so they didn't give him the job. He didn't get the job. So what he did is he went off into the forest. He's a gas station attendant in Oregon. He went off into the forest, found a Port Orford cedar log, sawed off the pieces that he wanted, hauled them out a half a mile to the road, took them to a mill where they were milled down, and then he built his own boat, built his own wooden boat, and somehow trailered it to Green River, Wyoming, and put it on the Green River. And rode all the way down the Green River through, Gates of Lodore and all that section up there and near Vernal, and then down through all those canyons of the Green, Cataract Canyon, down to Lees Ferry to, and at about Lava Falls, he caught up to that expedition that he tried to get a job with and kind of just said, hey, howdy, how you guys doing? And those days, to see another boat on the Grand Canyon was, it just didn't happen. It was like a very isolated place. But basically, along the way, Buzz Holmstrom taught himself to row. He was a self-taught rower, and I think that's interesting because when you start thinking about how do people learn to row, one of the most time-tested ways that people learn to row are when people get thrown in situations where they kind of have to teach themselves. And so there's video of Buzz running sections of the Grand Canyon, and because he came back and repeated his expedition with another guy who had a movie camera, so they filmed kind of a recreation of it. Like that was in the 1930s sometime, and so you get to see him rowing. You get to see him, using ferry angles and doing a number of techniques that we still use today on the river that he obviously figured out for himself in this one wooden boat. And, And there's a great account by a historian whose last name is Lavender. I can't think of his first name, about Buzz and his, and what he would do is he'd come down a rapid. Sometimes he would scout them from both sides of the river. This is in the Grand Canyon or Cataract or whatever. And then he'd carry his duffel down, you know, so that he lightened his boat. And then he had every intention of lining, but he was by himself. So get in the boat and just say, okay, I'm going for it. And so he rode, you know, Soap Rapid, which at that time was considered one of the hardest rapids in the Grand Canyon. At the lower water levels that they saw and whatever. But anyway, he was described as he entered the rapid, he'd spit on both hands to get a better grip of the oars, and he'd go into the rapid singing Barnacle Bill the Sailor at the top of his lungs.
Oh, man.
Yeah. That's outstanding.
Yeah, he's, you know, whatever we do, we call first ascents. They don't really quite compare to what some of the pioneers did. The pioneers of river running, you know, really were out there in a way that we'll never even understand. Particularly now in the YouTube, you know, GoPro generation, we'll never understand what that was like.
Yeah, I one time tried to craft a rush. I made a cataract frame out of wood, where I tied it together with rope to try to simulate what the Russians did, yeah. And rode it down the lower hood. It was sketchy. It doesn't want to stay together. It's super flexible. It just gave me, doing a lower hood on that cataract was one of the most dangerous things I've done. And it gave me a lot of respect for not having as good of equipment.
Yeah.
And at any time it could have fallen apart and just everything. I just was swimming next to a bunch of pieces of wood.
Yeah. 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 The Russians were crazy. Unbelievable what they did, the hikes they did to get in carrying all their gear and building their frames when they got in. Unbelievable.
I wanted to try to simulate that, and it's impressive. And also with Buzz Holstrom, I didn't know who he was. I was reading about the Grand Ron last year, a couple years ago, and his gravesite is at the confluence of the Grand Ron and Wallawa rivers. University store again. And I got him confused when I heard that it's Buzz, what's his name again?
Holmstrom, H-O-L.
So I got him confused with Buzz Holstrom. I thought that the astronaut was buried there.
Oh,
so I started doing research and ended up learning a ton about Buzz Holstrom, and an impressive dude, like a legend in the boating community.
Yeah. Huh. Wow. Well, I'm looking at the stack of books here by my desk, but I can't grab it quickly enough to reference any information here. But anyway, he's... You know, there's a lot to be learned from what he did in terms of how people can learn to row. Because, I know in conversations I've had with you, Zach, you have told me that you believe that experience is the factor that teaches people how to row. You can teach them so much, and then after that, it's all experience. And Buzz Holmstrom is as good a proof of that as anybody I could think of.
Oh, that's good to hear. I'm sure there's proof the other way.
Affirms our training style, right, Zach? I mean, that's the same thing we do. Is
good luck. We're
going to give you the fundamentals, but then basically you just need to follow on and figure it out, because, you know, it's like riding a bike. Like, you can tell people what to do, but at some point they've just got to do it, right?
Yeah, there's a big practice element. I think people, we could talk – actually, I could talk about this forever. I was just thinking we probably need to close it up here, but I would love to have you on again to talk about – rowing, like a rowing progression, like how people learn to row.
Okay.
And I think that would be a cool discussion, because I think some people learn from practice, and some people learn from being told things. And I bet anybody in the world, you know the most about teaching rowing, and especially like having taught a lot of people to row, and having studied this so much for the past couple of years. So I hope we can continue this discussion another time.
Well, I'd be happy to. I have to say that there's a lot of people who are great rowing teachers, and that, you know, there's so many traditions and companies and ways people have taught. There's a lot of great experience teaching rowing out there. I don't claim to be anywhere near the authority. I like it as much as anybody else. That's for sure.
You're being modest. I'm going to claim you're an authority. I'm going to try to claim that. And I think that in Whitewater, we talked about this a little bit with Mark last week, that there's all these individual companies and different traditions.
Yeah.
And we kind of get caught up like breathing our own smoke in our own way of doing things.
Yeah.
And I think you've really made an effort to learn about a lot of different people and styles. And so you're one of the few people that has gathered all that information and has an understanding of the different styles. So I love that.
Well, a little bit. And I was, you know, quickly, I got, I worked with Echo. I had an opportunity where we had to teach ourselves a season on the Tuolumne because all our experienced guides left. And that was a key part of my learning. And, but I got to row with the Arctic Grand Canyon crew of the 1970s. I got to row with them on a subway trip. I went to Chile and worked on the BOBO with the Ors Sobek guides. I got to, you know, get influenced by that tradition. I worked with Steve Curry from the Colorado Plateau, Western River, and all of his experience. So I was very fortunate to get a little cross pollination where a lot of people stick with one company and don't get that kind of opportunity. I had some good luck along the way.
Yeah.
I'm excited to continue this conversation.
All right.
I'm very passionate about, like, I'm passionate about good rowing. I love to see it. I love to watch people who are really good. It's, to me, it's very much an art form, and I'm excited to continue the conversation about this for sure.
I like that. I love when you use that term, because I hesitate to use it because I don't want to sound, you know, highfalutin, but I agree. I think it's an art. It can be an art form for sure.
When it's done well, I've struggled over the years sort of the same way to think about how to frame it. But when you see the right people do it, I don't think there's another word for it. It just, that seems to be what it is. So
yeah. Nice. Bravo. I agree.
Well, Zach, shall we, do we want to hear a mail piece real quick?
Let's do one. Yeah. Or maybe we can do both. I'll read one really fast. So we've had some good viewer mail this week. That's kind of fun to, go over, and I'll read the one about, I got to find it here real quick. So this is from Barry. It says, "Hi, I really like the podcast. Please keep doing them. Thanks for the encouragement, because that's fun for us too, but if they're terrible, we don't want to keep doing it, I guess. I guess we'll keep doing it. Anyway,
so we've been doing them, so.
Yeah, we might as well keep it up. He says, "I want to offer some constructive criticism about the IRF episode. I thought the focus on kayak logistics/politics aspect of RAF certification was a bit dry. I would have been much more interested in hearing about the content of the course themselves. What is the syllabus? What skills make someone a class 4 boater? What are some skills that even experienced river guides could often lack? What are some regional stylistic differences in approaches to rafting? I was really hoping those types of topics would have been touched." And cool. Thanks, Bray. That's a good email for us. I was personally interested in the politics. That's just where I was at the moment. So that's why we went there. But I sent your questions on to Mark, and he's going to give me some answers this week, and we'll just post answers on the blog. So thanks for asking the questions, and we'll get you some answers pretty quick.
Those are great. And I could actually see a longer conversation on some of those topics as well.
Oh yeah. It'd be awesome. And it's good for us to get emails like this, because we understand what you guys who are listening want. So I was excited about this email. Thanks for the constructive criticism.
Yeah. And we'll get to the next one next week. So we got a couple emails coming in, and we can.
Yeah, the next one's so good. It's about inflatable kayaks, and I think we can do an hour on it. It makes me so happy.
That's why I'm saying we should wait.
Oh man, that one's so good.
It's a strategic decision.
Oh man, my favorite quote. I can't just say one thing about this email. Please. Okay. Whoever wrote it basically called out Thrill Seekers as a copy of Thrill Seekers. They said it right?
Stiletto as a copy. As a knockoff of the Thrill Seeker.
Yeah, which are fighting words in some circles. And so I can't wait to have this discussion, but we'll leave it there.
Yes. Agreed. Yes. Very good things were brought up. Yeah. And we look forward to discussing them and possibly having a few guests come on to help with the conversation or make it more interesting.
I think we should do that next week. Have those guests come on and just do this viewer email as an entire episode.
Exactly. And, so,
yeah.
Just all right.
Try to do gear of the week.
We have gear of the week real quick?
Yeah, real quick.
All right. You guys go first.
Eric, I know you're excited.
Well, I don't know if excited is the word I would use, but I did have something this week, although I just closed it. Cambridge Welding, you can barely find things on their website. They're hard to find, but they do sell their stuff at Cascade Outfitters or Cascade, whatever they are in Boise. And if you're ever headed to the to do Hell's Canyon, you basically can drive past. You can pick up stuff at their place. They make these super cool, you know, ammo cans. So, like, as a guide, you live out of an ammo can, right? Like, you know, some of us have moved over to Pelican cases.
You should.
But same basic principle,
you
right? Like,
live out of an ammo can, but people do.
Yeah, people do. A lot of river guides do. There's a long history of people doing it. Whatever. It's like, it's the place you put your personal little stuff, you know, and like your toothbrush and your deodorant, should you ever choose to use it. those kinds of things, right? And they make this like bigger version of it that straps down really well and it's just durable. It's kind of the right size. You could get them from them powder coated and they're awesome. So if you ever come across those, definitely worth looking into.
Cool.
Nice.
I've seen them. They're nice. They're pretty sweet. My gear of the week is Sup Paul. I know Sup Paul's not gear. I just really like Sup Paul.
He's a human being.
He's a human being.
He's a human being. But he's starting a new vlog series. Just Google like Sup Paul vlog, a video log. And I just like Sup Paul a lot. And I think even though it's about supping, I can't wait to watch it. And for those of you out there that don't know who Sup Paul is, find him on Facebook, follow him. He's an interesting cat.
Yeah. Got lots of good stuff.
Yeah.
My gear of the week is kayak wheelies. So we'll post a link to exactly what this is. But basically, Jacob created these wheels that you can attach to the back of your kayak. So if you're like hiking in along like a logging road or a long road where it would be kind of annoying to shoulder your boat, you can just attach these wheels and then throw them in your boat afterwards, and it saves a lot of pain. Cool. And you go a lot quicker. So the concept was originally brought to his attention by our friend Anna Herring, who now lives in Australia, and then a few changes were made by our friend Emil, and then Jacob kind of dialed in what exactly worked, and he's had his for a number of years. I have a pair that I've used a couple years now, and they're pretty rad. Of course, they don't work that well in like off-road or like bushwhacking conditions, but as far as logging roads and like, you know, just long roads that you can't drive a car on but are relatively flat or decent sized gravel, they are super awesome.
Are they for sale?
We do not have any for sale, and don't really have the production capabilities, but Jacob made a tutorial, and basically it's all supplies that you can get at Home Depot for not a lot of money. And it takes, you know, one evening. If you're mechanically inclined, probably would take a lot less time.
You should sell an ebook, like make some money off of this. Sell for $1.
I'll talk about it. Well, now
you might make $10.
Yeah. I know, exactly. He's already given it away for free.
those are free advanced copies. That's how you move up on the Amazon. That's good marketing. You move up on Amazon with free advanced copies, and then you sell it for $1 and make $10.
Oh, okay.
For a second there, I thought that this story was going to Priscilla saying, like, after they weren't for sale, is her just saying, like, I have this awesome thing and you can't have it or get it.
Like, I did too.
But it's outstanding.
My gear of the week is this thing that we have and you can't get.
I was really hoping that's where this is going.
I should have done that.
Outstanding. Cool. Yeah.
We did it.
Any other... All right. Well, thanks to Peter Fox for coming on, telling us stories. And we're going to do everything we can to coax him back, because I think this is probably my favorite episode we've done. So,
yeah, me too.
You know, continue those conversations. If you were listening, thanks for hanging out and listening. Hopefully you're riding the wave that's coming and going out and going boating. So have fun out there. Shoot us some emails. If there's anything you want us to talk about or have any feedback or whatever, shoot us an email, therivertalkpodcast@gmail.com. Otherwise, we will maybe be back next week or maybe after the first of the year. We'll see.